such a wonderful, I think all of it's wonderful, but it's especially wonderful today to hear how the Lord calls Moses. I want to keep reminding us as we look at Exodus to play different parts, to put yourself in different positions in the story that you might see all that the Lord has to teach us. And we've talked in the past of seeing it from the Egyptians' point of view and the Jewish point of view and God's point of view and the Christian point of view. And I want to keep that alive in you to keep looking from the different points of view because there's so much here. For those of you that have been raised in a Christian tradition, we have heard this story all of our lives, much like Jewish people that are maybe among us or listening who have also heard this all their lives. And it is the story of the deliverance of the Jews. But it is a picture of a deliverance to come for both the Jew and the Gentile. Messiah is called deliverer, and that is who they are looking for, is Messiah, the deliverer who will come from Moses' time forward. Actually, the prophecies we've seen from the very covenant of Abraham when the people were called to be his people and prophesied into existence, there was this prophecy next to it that they would suffer this 430 years and be called out and back to this land of milk and honey. And we're going to see that calling reiterated again today. In our lifetime, we have seen prophecy fulfilled in the calling of Jews back to their land again. That too was prophesied many places in the latter part of the Old Testament. They would be dispersed and they would be called back. And we have seen that. They will also see their deliverer when he comes. So let's read this with open hearts and also look particularly at Moses, who is a picture of the deliverer, and he is the one whom God promises. If you read Acts 7, you can kind of stay concurrent with the whole book of Exodus in Acts 7. It will compile the Jewish history in a little segment. And there's a picture of Moses being there will be one like Moses, which is predicted later in the Pentateuch. One would come like Moses to deliver the people, like Moses, and that's the promise of Messiah. And so we see, as we see Moses, if Messiah is going to be like him, let's look at Moses today as something like Messiah will be like, okay? So far, he was born in difficult times with his people in captivity. He was drawn out of water, okay? His name means out of water or named up, which is also the end of the Pharaoh's name, is the Osi part, in the Egyptian name, in the Hebrew name, it is out of water, okay? He's drawn out of water, and we will keep meditating on water as we move through this book. Let's just move right into it. I think I left off a little early last week, and so I'm going to finish reading what I haven't read. We have a lot to cover, so I'm going to fly. So read quickly or just listen. One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Glancing this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Now the killed here in the Hebrew is he struck him. He struck him down. It is not the same word we're going to see in a moment. Listen. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting and asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" Now here we see, if you can identify with Moses here, it would probably be in our time if we had seen like Burning in Mississippi or some horrible movie of racial prejudice where you just want to kill the sheriff. You know what I'm saying? The bad guy who pistol whips the guy on the chain gang, okay? It's that identification with, it's so evil that goodness, that the saving rises up in you to rescue this person, and death is what ensues. It isn't premeditated murder. It is the saving of someone at the expense of someone else who was bringing evil upon them. So now Moses, he saves this bile rises up in him, and he strikes him and kills him to save this brother he sees afflicted. Then he comes, and he begins to be the peacemaker. He asks the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" So we see the peacemaker element in Moses' heart. Not only the saving from evil, but the wanting them to get along. Now keep this in mind as we watch the call of God on Moses, because so far in the story, he's behaving like a really good union man. It's the them in the us, okay? We're really bad against the bad guy. We're against that establishment. We're against the evil. And we're going to build up the fellowship here. We're going to build up the brotherhood. We got a secret sign. We are attached. And we're going to get along, okay? And this is not what God uses in Moses. That is not what he uses here. He uses the might of the Spirit. We're going to see the Spirit in Moses. So this doesn't work. The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us?" The very thing Moses would become, God chastises out of him in the flesh. He scares him. He scares him so bad, you'll see what happens when even he burns in a bush, he can't convince the guy to come. Okay? He really puts the fear of his own self into Moses. "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." So he's afraid. How has this become known? Someone saw that. And he's not thinking that the guy he saved told, but how has this become known? This has become known. When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian. This kill is premeditated murder. He intended to take him by force and kill him. Okay, it was premeditated, Pharaoh's. So he went to live in Midian. Now Midian is in the southeastern portion of the Sinai, and kind of in the middle of where Arabia would be, on the edge of the Red Sea, where the Sea of the Gulf of Aqaba is today. So some of where Jordan would be called today, in that southern part where they vacation at Aqaba. So it's in that area, but very dry, and next to this Red Sea is part of that landscape. So he goes to Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now, this is another deliverer picture. The first time that he leaves his place of birth, the first time he leaves that land, he goes and he sits by a well. The first time that Jesus leaves his and goes into Samaria, he sits by a well. There's a picture there. We'll see pictures over and over again in the life of Jesus that are just pictured right like Moses. In theology books, they call this a type. He's a type with a little t of Messiah. That's what Moses is. And Messiah would fulfill these things. And they all have meaning. You all, in the Hebrew, everything has meaning. It just is meaning, picture on picture on picture. And so here's a picture again. He goes and sits by a well. Now what happens? Now a priest of Midian who had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock, their little shepherdesses. He's a priest. We don't know what that means, who he's a priest of exactly, but we'll find out in just a second who he is. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered the flock. Okay, so here's the hero part of him that we really like, the white horse part. He's is not beaten out of him. He saves the women. Okay, he shoos off the bad shepherds and he lets them water their sheep. When the girls returned to Reuel, their father. Now, it doesn't say women here. They really are girls. Okay, so they're probably young girls and teen, you know, still with it being called girls. So somewhere maybe from 9 up to 20, somewhere in there. But they're girls. And you can just see the father, see them all talking, coming back. Okay, when the girls returned to Reuel, their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." An Egyptian has saved us from the shepherds. Okay? And we know that he still looked Egyptian. He probably had the short cropped hair. And I don't know if he had his eye makeup on anymore, but he may have because they kept it for bugs out of his eyes. He probably still had the linen garb pleated because he was royal. Somehow he had fled out there. There was something about him that they knew he was Egyptian. He looked, whether he was groomed, that's how they identified him, not as a Hebrew. He rescued us from the shepherds. This is such an interesting thing because both, he becomes a shepherd, David is a shepherd, and Jesus is called the great shepherd of the sheep. Okay, so in this place, and later there are terrible warnings against bad shepherds in Israel. What book was that we did at the retreat? Was it Ezekiel? I think it was Ezekiel, where the Lord prophesies against the bad shepherds who give trodden bad food to the sheep. They're not concerned about the care of the sheep. Jesus uses this analogy too about the bad shepherd, the hireling, who does not really care about the sheep. So this Egyptian, this one who looks like a foreigner, comes to save them. "And where is he?" he asked his daughters. "Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat." Now, Reuel, their father, also has this name Jethro, which we'll see in a minute, which can mean chief or leader. It's a high name, like he's someone set apart. And Reuel means friend of God. Very similar to what Abraham was called. Abraham was called a friend of God. So this man is a priest. And remember, you all, there is no religion about to God right now. It's just that men are calling on the name of the Lord again. From way back at Noah's time, they've begun to call on the name of the Lord again. And Abram set aside. But there are peoples all over the earth who are probably still calling on the name of the Lord in one way or another, whatever his name is, the one who made everything. Moses agreed to stay with the man and gave his daughters, and he who gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Now, obviously, this is a condensed story. I mean, I'm sure some wooing took place, but he gave his daughter Zipporah, I hope so, to Moses in marriage. And Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, "I have become an alien in a foreign land." What an interesting thing to say. How long has he been an alien in a foreign land? How long? 430 years, hasn't he? He's been in a land all along, an alien in a foreign land. But he's feeling foreign right now. Okay, he's really foreign now because he doesn't really know where he fits anymore. His life is kind of everything he was, you know, he must have been told, y'all, he must have been told in the early days that something was special about him being saved out of that river. And that I would have told myself that. I would have said, "You are in a special position in that palace for your people. There's something about where you are. You keep your eye on where you are because you're one of us." Because somehow in him was this defense of the Hebrews. He did not borrow the hatred of the Egyptian for the Hebrew. He knew he was Hebrew. He knew they were his brothers. And yet he's been confounded here. In trying to save, he's actually been thrown out. I mean, he's used up. And he's out in this place with someone who's at least faithful to God and is married, but now he has a son. And this son isn't with all the other Israelites. He's not named with the tribe. He's not a part of the group. And so he names him this name, an alien in a strange country, in a foreign land. During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. So the Hebrews were calling on God. They did go to him for help. They were crying out their distress. They needed help. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. Okay, he remembered. Remember how we talked about his remembering is to act. He remembers to act on their behalf, but he is concerned about them. And they, in turn, for us to have the report in the Pentateuch of what occurred in the promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, must have been looking for deliverance, crying out. They must have known. Why would you stay? This is one thought I've had this week. Why would you stay in a land for 430 years? Now, y'all remember, we've been here 200, you know, something like that. 240 years we've been called a country. So, 234 years we've been called a country. So imagine now, it's 430 years. They're going to just decide they're going to go back, okay? You know, they've lived generations in this land and prospered until this affliction came upon them and it intensified and intensified. But their thoughts of leaving
They're not asking to just leave, or they're not thinking here, we have greater numbers, let's just rise up against them. They have no hope with that, because the others have weapons and horses and wheels that ride on chariots. Okay, they don't have that hope of rising up. But they're not, the crazy thing about this story to me, I use that respectfully, Lord, but the crazy thing about the story to me is that the very thing that the Pharaoh was scared of, that they would multiply and somehow go with an enemy and take over the land, when they asked to leave, would have been a way out of that. Hey, these people want to leave, great. No danger from them. Hey, the problem is solved. They keep multiplying and we can solve the problem. They want to leave. That is not going to happen. Okay, there's something really innately evil about this hold that Egypt has over the Hebrews and their inability to break free. They are truly slaves. God hears them and he's concerned. Now, chapter 3. Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. Again, this is a title, like a great man. I forget exactly the title of y'all right here, but I'll find it out for you. I read it this morning, and I can't read and talk at the same time. The flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. This isn't the highest one, but it's a high one, something like 6,500 feet above sea level. And he climbs this with his sheep. There an angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. The angel of the Lord in the Old Testament is used as God. When he appears, it is as if they have seen God. This is shown over and over again in the future in the Old Testament. You'll see him appear again. He has already struggled with Jacob and given him the name of Israel. And he'll come again to report on Samson's birth. And again, he'll come again. He came with Abraham to talk about Sodom and Gomorrah. He is this picture of the Lord, the presence of the Lord. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight. Why, the bush does not burn up. Have you been watching the fires on the news out west? And I saw one the other night, and this pine tree just burst into flame, giant torch. You know, just full of sap, resin, just a torch on fire, exploding with fire. And they just explode to the other trees. It's just enormous. And he sees this bush, okay? It's probably, it's not a tree, it's a bush. But, you know, it hits him immediately when he sees it. It's on fire, but maybe the leaves are glistening. I don't know what he sees, but it's not what you normally see when you see something being consumed. And burned, and rapidly burned. And of course, in a dry place like that, things would have burned very rapidly. So he probably sees, and it's fire in a place like that. You would kind of be afraid of fire in an arid place. So he sees it, and he turns aside, but it's this miracle before his eyes. The bush is not burning. Why is this bush not burning? When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, isn't that wonderful? That the Lord, who is everywhere at once, is actually present to the time as well as in the future and in the past. He's present. He's actually in the moment. He sees him go over. He's in the moment with him. I love that for my life. He's in my moments. He's there. You know, he's the one I can say, oh, did you see what happened? Even though I know he knows what happened. You know, I know that he just saw what happened too. He was right there in the moment. When he saw he'd gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses. Now this is exclamation point. Moses. This is loud. Sudden. And Moses said, here I am. Okay. Yes, sir. Sir, here I am. Okay. And what's so interesting is the very pronouncement that he gives is the one that God answers back with. Listen in a moment. Here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. So apparently he removes his sandals and he stands there. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. I can't understand that. What a picture. He actually could have looked and he didn't. I mean, he'd be terrified. What's very interesting here is it's the only place where you hear an angel appear and he doesn't say, "Don't be afraid. Now, don't be afraid. I'm getting ready to," you know. All the other places they're afraid. And he's still standing. I think I would have been over backwards, perhaps. You know, I would have been scared or fainting or, you know, my heart so hard, I probably wouldn't be able to hear. Like, what did he say? But this is very clear. Almost when you hear later when God speaks to Elijah in the still small voice, so real and authentic and present and sort of, if you can imagine, this is me talking, not the Lord. If time is slowed down, like when you hear something extremely significant and it just sort of hangs there, you know, you get it. He is slowed. He is in an eternal moment with God. He is taking this in. He can recall it later verbatim. He was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering." He wasn't just concerned to set them free and fulfill a promise. He was concerned about their suffering. This is a God who is concerned when we suffer. It isn't just about the outcome. He isn't one who says, "You know, it'll work out in the end, so just bear up right now. Just be a little patient. This will work out." He really is concerned about your suffering in the midst of the difficulty you're going through. "So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them." In other words, he's observed the evil. He has seen the evil. "So now go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." I think probably until that time, Moses' heart was full of delight, don't you think? He's seen. He's going to answer. Yes, he's come down. Oh, yes. "So I'm sending you to go." You know, I mean, that part was just not at all what he wanted to be at the end of that. You know, maybe like, "You're my good buddy." You know, he'd heard, you know, maybe knew the story with Abraham. "You're my friend. I'll tell you in advance what I'm about to do." That's a wonderful conversation. "But I'm going to send you." You know, and now he's almost 80 years old. He's been a long 40 years in this wilderness, y'all. He was 40 when he went, and he's been 40 years out there. Now he's a ripe 80-year-old. Ready, he's got children, but now they were younger. They were younger at older ages at this point. In fact, when he dies much later, it says he's still like a young man. Good eyesight, strong body. So Moses is very young in his body. But he is called now. God tells him in real detail, "I've heard the cry, I'm concerned, I've seen the suffering, I've seen how they're afflicted, I've come down to help, I'm sending you." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" So he goes from, "Here I am," to, "Who am I?" Okay? Isn't that great? I love that. Second phrase, "Here I am. Who am I?" Okay? In response, y'all, do you find that in your own walk with God? I do all the time. I ask, "Who am I?" a whole lot more than, "Here I am." Okay, a whole lot more. And it's an answer back to God. His image in us is a reflection. We are made in His image. And you'll see this play on words, the fact of self, that we are a person contained and made to exist with God. We bear His image. And so now he asks the question of the ages, "Who am I that you would call me? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" Verse 12, "And God said, I will be with you." Now, all of us would like to think that at this point, even in our own lives, when God tells us something to do, and then we say this, "Who am I? Who am I to go do this?" When he says, "I'll be with you," that it would be enough for us to say at that point, okay, you promised you'd be with me. You've made the call. You promised you'd be with me. I'm going. I will do this thing. But that is not where Moses is. And that's usually not where we are either. We're not above Moses in this. We can identify. I will be with you, the Lord says, and this will be the sign to you. I love his signs. He's just got these great signs. And this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. Now, you know he's on bated breath here. Okay, great. This is a relief. Thank goodness he's going to give me a sign. Then I'll know he's with me. Here we go. Here's the sign. When you brought the people out of Egypt, you'll worship God on this mountain. Oh, you know, in other words, he really expects success out of this venture. The Lord really is seeing past me and my problems to the solution, and that's where he wants me to fix my hope that this will come to pass. Okay, you are, again, a great one. You're putting yourself in this story. A great one in the thing God calls you to do. To see that the thing that he's called you to do is done. Jesus says this later. When you ask for the thing and believe in your heart it is so, it will be so. He pushes you beyond this fear of can't be into that land of promise. And you're dwelling there by faith. And he pushes him to the same path of his fathers. Right to the path of faith. You will worship me on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? Now, it's interesting here. Is he really interested in the name? Or is he interested... what is he doing here? Is this kind of like Peter, James, and John on the Mount of Transfiguration? He's just making up conversation. Hey, this is great. Let's build three tents. Okay. Let's see if I go, who will I say your name is? I mean, somehow, if God sent him and he's going to be with him, what name would they possibly recognize other than the father of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Would that not have been enough? But apparently, God is the one in this conversation with Moses drawing the question out. What is my name? What is my name? Who am I? Who should I tell them you are? And this is what God says. God said to Moses, I am who I am. That in the verb, in the that tense means I am, I always have been, I always will be, I am. I am, okay? And it's that echo to again, we've seen, you know, here I am, and who am I? And just tell him, I am sent you. Okay, so he's put back into him. I'm the one who made you. I'm the one who made them. I'm the one God. I'm not those other gods over there in Egypt. I'm not somebody you're going to carry on a pole, and there's going to be some talisman they can carry to sort of put over there and some hocus pocus and magic that they'll know that this is me. They're going to know if they are really worshiping me, and their cries have hit my ears. I think they are. I think they're going to understand this when you say, I am sent you. Okay? Because in their deepest souls, they were crying out to the one they couldn't see, and he could see them. And he said, you just tell them, I am sent you. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. So then he gives them the historical God, the God of your fathers. The God you can trust on what his actions have been and what his promises have been. It isn't a vacuum. Remember, Romans says that Abraham's faith, the father of all faith, believed that God was able to do that which he had promised. He wasn't just going to do what he had promised. That would have taken a lot of faith, I think. It's the little tiny seed of faith that said he's able to do what he promised. That's what God is looking for in Moses here. That he's going to say, I know that you're able to bring this off. Because you're able, I will go. Because he couldn't say that, then God says, you'll worship on this mountain. You're going to have some things. And by the way, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There are some historical facts you can put your faith in. They are true. I have a track record and you can trust in it. Okay? It's absolutely impeccable record. I am that God. This is my name forever, the name by which I am to be remembered from generation to generation. That God, that same God. Go assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me and said, I have watched over you. And see, he gives him the entire speech. This is exactly what I want you to say. I have watched over you and have seen what has been done to you in Egypt. And I have promised to bring you up out of your misery in Egypt into the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. A second time he says this. Now, he promised in Abraham's day that this people would go into captivity as a sign that Abraham would even have children. Okay? And he said they'll go there because the evil of this Amorite nation has not reached its peak. Very interesting. In other words, God loves all the people of the earth. He gives them, they're all in pictures, categories. He loves them all as real people. But we all play a part in his purposes and his plan. And we all have a time where we are given truth and a time where we can either follow it or reject it. And again, he tries and tries and tries until after a certain amount of disobedience and rebellion, he gives you over to it to have its full result so that the judgment that comes to those actions might then lead you again for mercy. And with these Amorites, now he let them get away with terrible, terrible things until this time, and now their time is up. And it's time for the Hebrews to come back. He had not just forgotten them for 400 years over there. Oh dear, I think this would be a good day to rescue them. He had actually prophesied that, knowing the end from the beginning. That's why I say keep your eyes on even prophetic things today. He knows what he is about. Just as sure as he called them back, Jesus Christ is going to come to earth again. Do not make any mistake about that. There is a certain day he will come. He says he doesn't even know that day. But it's a day. And it's going to come when the Jews cry out, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. That's when he said he'd come. He said, you will not see my face again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And all in the latter part of the Old Testament, the preparation for the Jewish nation to understand Messiah again and the hardening to be lifted. We will see a hardening given and a hardening prophesied to be lifted that we to be in prayer for. And in strong warnings about us as believers who also suffer in unbelief and can be in danger of being cut off from some promises by not walking in belief. We have that choice before us all the time to believe God or not believe God. And people say, well, I'm not really sure there is a God. Well, that's not really the issue. You can either believe him or not believe him, or you can trust him or not trust him. But convincing someone to believe him is not our job. We bear witness to the fact he's true in our lives. And this is what God is calling Moses to do. You bear witness that I called you, and this is what I told you to say. Now, and see, what could they say to this? They weren't going to say, well, how did he call you? How do you know it was him? See, that wasn't going to be the part of the discussion. The discussion was going to be, this is his name, and he called me very specifically. He also calls him to a land flowing with milk and honey. This is a good and a spacious place in contrast to the dark imprisonment that they have in Egypt and the slavery they have in Egypt. The land of milk and honey speaks of a place where there are lots of bees, okay? And where there are lots of bees, there are lots of flowers, okay? And milk means there's lots of grass for cows to graze on, goats. So they have lots of milk. And this is reiterated in Isaiah when they're going to be, attacked by outsiders and their land laid waste till briars just take it over and they can no longer farm. And he says, but you'll still eat curds and honey. Your people will still keep a calf and two goats, and you'll have so much milk you won't know what to do with it. He's still going to keep his promises, even when it's desolated, that it's still a land of milk and honey. He'll send the bees into the ravines, he said, and whistle from the flies from Egypt. And he will preserve them even in a hard time. So he calls them to this land of milk and honey. The elders of Israel will listen to you. Then you and the elders are to go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. He has met with us. Isn't that a wonderful phrase? The Lord You know, we talk about meetings, and as believers, we have lots of meetings that we go to. And it's so important. Some of you may wonder why every time I ask the Holy Spirit to come up here and anoint and do something like, isn't He there? Isn't He here anyway? He is. But I want Him to meet with us. Okay, that's what the meeting is all about. The meeting is about being with Him. And in an old pamphlet I had in college, it said when fellowship is about, you know, many logs burn brightly together. One little log on the side is just kind of a smoking, you know, little log. You put a bunch together, you got a big fire. That's what happens when the people of God come together. And when God meets with us, we have to keep our focus on us meeting with Him and not just the meeting with each other or just an agenda we need to follow, but what does God have for us in this hour? What does He want for us in this day? He is present to the moment. He sees you come in the building and sit down, just like He saw Moses go over to the bush. He sees you. He wants to meet with you. Do you want to meet with Him? That's what we ask. He has met with us. Let us take a 3-day journey into the desert to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. So I will stretch out my hand and strike the Egyptians with all the wonders that I will perform among them. After that, he will let you go. Now, would you have called what is about to occur wonders? I don't believe I would have called them wonders. I would have said terrors. Okay, he is going to send terrors among them. But they really are wonders in the sense that they are so other. And as we study the plagues and we get to them, they are so in the face of the Egyptian practices with their gods. Specifically in the faces of those God, the kind of gods they're worshiping. He shows himself to be more wonderful than they are. Over and again. It isn't just enough to deliver them. I mean, God could have said here, I'm going to give Pharaoh a dream the very night you get back, and he's going to decide you're bad news to have in the land, and he's going to say, hey, pack their suitcases and let's get them out. He could have done it that way. He did not do it that way. He illustrated what he calls his wonders, his glories, in this place. Of who he is the real God in the face of the false gods. And he makes a testimony among the Egyptians of his presence in his people. The elders will listen, and then you and the elders are to go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Let us take a 3-day journey into the desert to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. Then he says he'll stretch out his hand. And I will make the Egyptians, verse 21, favorably disposed toward this people, so that when you leave, you will not go empty-handed. Every woman is to ask her neighbor and any woman living in her house for articles of silver and gold and for clothing which you will put on your sons and daughters. And so you will plunder the Egyptians. You know, when I read this, I think that would be kind of hard, you know, to ask the person I've been a slave to give me some gold and silver. He's going to make them ask. He's promised it. But even to the people, they have to step out by faith. It is not, they just wake up like Santa Claus and there it is, all around the tree, and then they get to leave Egypt. Okay? They have to ask. They'll have to take a step of faith too. They'll have to anticipate this. They're being told way in advance of it. Moses answered, what if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, the Lord did not appear to you? Okay, here it comes. These are the real human questions. How do we know he appeared to you? They will ask this, you see. And he's anticipating it. What will they say and how will I answer this one? Then the Lord said to him, what is in your hand? A staff. He answered. A staff was that long pole that had the hook on the end. And a shepherd would use the hook to grab a sheep when it was getting away, and then he'd use the bottom of it to pop him in the butt and keep him back in line again. So it was a rod and a staff, and they comfort us. And he had the staff in his hand. The Lord said, throw it on the ground. Moses threw it on the ground, and it became a snake, and he ran from it. Then the Lord said to him, I'd run from it too. Reach out your hand and take it by the tail. So Moses reached out and took hold of the snake, and it turned back into a staff in his hand. This, said the Lord, is so that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, he reiterates into Moses' soul, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has appeared to you. Now, I asked myself, I wonder if you did, why the snake thing? I mean, the snake was a picture of Satan, wasn't it? Yes. The serpent came and he tempted Eve. And when she fell, the Lord damned the serpent to the ground and said, you're going to crawl on your belly all your days and eat dust. And there'll be enmity between your offspring and the woman's offspring. And she will crush your head with her heel. The seed will. Now, the seed of woman, of course, is Messiah because women don't have seed. And this is the prophecy given way back in Genesis. There'll be a destruction of the snake. So he takes the staff and throws it down, and it becomes this image of Satan. Okay? He has dominion even over Satan. Okay? There is nothing that is greater than God. And he throws it down, and then Moses is even able to go down and pick it up and make it turn back into a staff again. There are wonderful pictures in the New Testament. Often you'll see, why in the world did Jesus say we could handle snakes and their poison won't kill us? This is what he means. Okay, Satan, and it could literally be snakes, but you know, that's gotten into a cult thing where people just handle snakes to show you. That's not what Jesus was about. It's the conquering of over evil. There is nothing too big for God who is in your midst. He is greater than he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. And later we also see a time where Paul, when he's preaching, is bitten by a viper. Comes out of the fire and bites him. And all the people say, oh, he's going to die. Well, this is it. He's been judged. He'll die. And he just goes right on preaching. And the people are stunned and realize he is not going to die. He must be a god. And they start to worship him. Okay, this would have been, could have been a response these people would have had. Nobody just handles a snake like that without fear. So he gives it, but this is not to the Egyptian at this point. It's to the Hebrew he's given this sign. God is greater than the serpent. It should have said in their minds, this picture, God is greater than Satan. He will conquer. Then the Lord said, put your hand inside your cloak. So Moses put his hand into his cloak, and when he took it out, it was leprous like snow. Now here again we see disease. What would have made someone later, we'll see him say, this is unclean, you can't approach God and be unclean. So again, something that would destroy, the destroyer from within. And with leprosy, you know, you lose feeling and you lose your nervous system. You're unable. The reason things die off is they can't feel, and so they get gangrene. They don't even know it. And so there's horrible destruction. And so he has this hand that goes in that would have been horrifying to him, instantly cancerous. And then he puts it back. He says, put it back in your cloak. And so Moses put his hand back into his cloak, and when he took it out, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. Then the Lord said, if they do not believe you or pay attention to the first miraculous sign, they may believe the second. But if they do not believe these two signs or listen to you, take some water from the Nile, pour it on the dry ground, the water you take from the river will become blood on the ground. Now here's this picture of blood and water, what flowed from the side of Messiah after he had paid the price. Blood and water, they are interchangeable in this exchange. In exchange, you will see baptism in the Red Sea coming up. You will see this blood being turned, that God is able to even speak it. But that was not enough to save them. He would promise something that was a sacrifice of that. And what blood meant to the Egyptian, you'll see later too. So this was another sign, but this was to the Hebrew at this point. Moses said to the Lord, oh Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you've spoken to your servant. In other words, I don't notice in our conversation here that suddenly I can speak with a golden tongue. Neither before or now can I speak. I am slow of speech and tongue. I don't know if he really had an impediment or if because he was raised in two cultures with two different languages. Often you'll see that if a child is partly raised in one and then re-enters another, then goes back to one, it's hard, and they'll have an accent if they're in both. They don't just pick up the second one and they just speak it like a native. They have an accent of one. And so it may take him some time. It could be that. It could be how the Lord answers here. The Lord said to him, who gave man his mouth? In other words, I know exactly whose mouth I asked to speak. I know exactly. Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? All these things are for God's glory. Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak and will teach you what to say. So he even takes that warning. He says here, even you can ask that question, go that far, and still I'll tell you I'll be with you. But Moses said, oh Lord, please send someone else to do it. Let's pray.